So welcome. This is the standard model course. I'll be splitting this with Stefania Gori. So I'm Gordon. I'm in office 474, and the email is first name, first initial, last name. The very long perimeterinstitute.ca. If you write PITP.ca, it doesn't always get through, so I'm not responsible if it bounces. And Stefania. I actually don't know what office she's in, but she's S. Gori. And I guess we'll start with just a quick overview. So what I like about this course is that it probably has the greatest number of Nobel Prize ideas per lecture. So it's got the greatest empirical support, probably the greatest depth and breadth of any physical theory that's ever been proposed. It's not complete, it's got some shortcomings, but it covers a lot of ground and it's really impressive. And it's really hard to break. So if you can break it, you'll probably win another Nobel Prize. So today, we'll just do an introduction. And that introduction will basically be a cast of characters. Cast of characters and notation, conventions, and so on. But for the other lectures, what we'd also like to discuss is the electroweak sector. That's not how you spell it. Electroweak sector. We're going to discuss the Higgs sector. And everyone can read that handwriting. So there's some lecture notes online on the course wiki page. They're not very clear. I never expected that they'd be put online, but it's totally fine that they are. But they've got a couple of typos, and the handwriting's probably totally illegible. So if you have any questions, you should just email me or point out mistakes. I'm sure there's some. But we'll also cover flavor physics, physics involving changes in quark generations. We're going to talk about quantum chromodynamics, QCD. We're going to talk about how the Higgs was discovered. We're going to talk about the standard model at one loop. So that's going to consist of electroweak precision measurements, or, well, they're usually called electroweak precision tests. We'll talk about the beta functions for QED and QCD. Talk about how the couplings run as a function of energy scale. We're going to discuss problems with the standard model, in particular the hierarchy problem. And that's, well, that should cover maybe most of the lectures. We'll adjust course depending on how quickly we get through things, depending on what the feedback is. And of course, feel free to send feedback. But I think that should cover most of the ground. Stefania should cover, I think, the last 7 lectures or so. So let's just start with notation. And the conventions. So first of all, since the standard model includes the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic forces, we're never going to be talking about gravity in this course, unfortunately. So I have the liberty of taking g mu nu to be 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, minus 1, 0, 0, minus 1, 0, minus 1. So this will essentially be equal to what's usually called eta mu nu. I like g mu nu. The context should never be ambiguous. When I write just the partials, that'll always mean d by dx mu, space-time derivative. And we're going to use natural units. And I know you've already seen this, but to establish notation and to connect with some more familiar ways of talking about particle physics, standard model, high energy theory, and so on, I just want to do a quick little review, lightning review of natural units. So we take h bar equal to c equal to 1. And the first part of this, if we take c equal to 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second in SI units, and we define that to be equal to 1, then that defines the ratio of meters per second. So that's going to be 1 over 3 times 10 to the 8. And it's just a number. This is just a definition of meter as a function of seconds. If we take h bar, it's basically 1.05 times 10 to the minus 34 joule seconds in SI units. I'm just going to round that to be about 10 to the minus 34 joule seconds. And we all remember that this is 10 to the minus 4 kilograms meters squared per second squared times seconds, the definition of a joule. I can rewrite this as 10 to the minus 34 kilogram meters times meters per second. And I can use the definition of meters per second. So that's going to give me 10 to the minus 34 kilogram meters and divided by 3 times 10 to the 8. And we know that the mass of a proton is about 0.938 GeV per c squared. So I'm going to round that to be GeV. I'm going to set c to 1. And we also know that the proton is 1.67 times 10 to the minus 27 kilograms. So now I can relate kilograms to GeV. So h bar is 1. It's 10 to the minus 34, 3 times 10 to the 8. 1 over 1.67 times 10 to the minus 27. GeV times meters. And this is going to define length in terms of GeV, because this is now set equal to 1 by definition. And in more familiar guise, this is going to give us that 1 over GeV centimeter is equal to 2 times 10 to the minus 14. This is just a number. And this is the definition of centimeter as a function of GeV, natural units. And we're going to use this a lot. So it comes up in every time we have to actually plug numbers in to make contact with data. Also, a fun fact. So the SI unit for a cross-section is a barn. Cross-section has the unit of area, has units of area. So, units of area, and the barn is defined to be 10 to the minus 24 centimeters squared. And so now we can convert centimeters squared to GeV, so we can always think of barns in terms of GeV. So a cross section is always going to go like some number times GeV to the minus 2. Okay. So that's all I want to say about natural units. Just a quick little reminder that for the accounting, that length is always going to have the same units as time, and that's always going to be in GeV inverse. Energy is always going to scale as momentum. It's going to scale as mass, and we'll always do it in terms of GeV. And that's all we're ever going to need, really. So once you give me an answer for some physical quantity in terms of GeV, that's the whole story. You can convert it to any units. If I write over here, can everyone see beyond the podium? Yeah? Pardon? Just in the top. Okay. So let's see. Okay, so now that we've, well, I can move the podium, can't I? Not that well. Okay, so standard model range of validity. So this is the really impressive thing about the standard model, that if we want to talk about the energy scales and or the distance scales, more conveniently, over which it's applicable, over which there is no experimental data to contradict anything about the standard model, the lower length bound is about 10 to the minus 3 times the radius of a proton, which is very impressive. So the radius of a proton heuristically goes like 1 over the proton mass. And in natural, well, if we convert this to conventional length units, then this is about 10 to the minus 16 or 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. So for distances shorter than about 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, we have no idea. We have to build an LHC, and the LHC will tell us if there's anything non-standard model-like going on. But down to about 10 to the minus 17, the standard model is the only game in town. There's no evidence for anything else. And if you try to put something else in there, you're likely to run into all kinds of experimental problems. So this is the minimum distance so far. Over length scales larger than that, standard model seems to check out just fine. So the max distance, I'll put an asterisk on the maximum distance, is actually the Hubble radius. So this is the inverse energy scale associated with the expansion of the universe. So I can move this up here. Do I have to do something special? Oh. Oh, cool. Okay. So R max is R Hubble, and it's given as the inverse of a dimensionful parameter. So this is the inverse Hubble radius. And H naught is basically 10 to the minus 33 electron volts. So if we convert this into a distance, then the Hubble radius is basically about 10 to the 28 plus 28 centimeters. So we've got a theory that tells us what nature is doing from about 10 to the minus 17 centimeters all the way out to 10 to the plus 28 centimeters, which is incredibly impressive. But this is a cheat, and that's why I put the asterisk on the maximum distance, because for maximum, we need a few other ingredients. So we're going to need the fact that there's at least classical GR to deal with the expansion of the universe. We're going to need the fact that there's that there's dark matter plus dark energy, and that we started off with some very particular initial conditions. Now, if you want to be more ambitious and you want to add a story of inflation, that's just a module. This is something that you can add without upsetting anything that we know and love about the standard model. So the initial conditions can be derived from the theory of inflation. So, but you supply those, and that tells you how to turn the crank. The dark matter and the dark energy just tell you how the universe is expanding and evolving. But once those things are put in place, they're essentially background features. And then all the physics of the standard model tells you how the universe evolves from moment to moment. It tells you how the neutrinos interacted with the visible matter when the universe was less than a second old, and then exactly at what moment the neutrinos stopped interacting, and nuclei were able to form when protons and neutrons weren't able to interconvert amongst each other anymore. It told you, and it actually makes a very firm prediction with these ingredients of exactly what the abundances of all the small chemical elements are, up to about atomic mass numbers of about 7 or 8. All the other ones were made in stars. It gives you very detailed predictions for exactly how much hydrogen you should have, what fraction of the hydrogen in the universe ought to be ionized, and so on. And Once the CMB sets in and matter starts to dominate the history of the universe, then all you ever really need is classical GR with these ingredients to tell you exactly how much matter there is. And the evolution of galaxies, and structure on the largest possible scales is all consistent with standard model physics. So it's extremely impressive, but of course we have no... So we have no quantum gravity. So this is obviously still an active area of research. So that's unfortunate. So essentially what that amounts for our purposes is that we have no black holes. Don't ask anything about black holes in this course. It's not part of the standard model. And that's it. So really the picture that we should have in mind is about 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. And then there's the standard model. And then 10 to the 28 centimeters. Beyond this, I'll just write out the bad word that some people don't like. So maybe beyond our Hubble radius, there are other patches, other Hubble radii for other observers with physics that's nothing like the standard model. This is a logical possibility. And we have nothing to say about that, at least not now. And down here, we have beyond standard model physics. So this is the physics that might be informative if we want to actually have an idea of what the initial conditions were. So this tells us how much matter versus antimatter. So technically we consider this a problem of beyond standard model physics because the standard model, just at face value, even with just these ingredients, can't tell you why there's more matter than antimatter. You need another theory. It's not that hard to write down another theory that tells you exactly how much matter there should be and for that to agree with data, but there's no verified scenario yet, so this is still an active area of research. And you can fold it in under initial conditions. If you just say, well, my initial condition is the universe started off with more matter than antimatter, then that's an acceptable but sort of contrived solution. And then I guess also quantum gravity is here. Basically everything that involves shorter distance scales. Okay. Is there... Oh, wait, I shouldn't do that, should I? Nope. There's another one, isn't there? Okay, so just to prepare ourselves, so now, yes?
How big is 10 to 28 centimeters? Is that the radius of the universe?
Roughly, yeah. Okay. So take the distance that light ray would have traveled from the very beginning, or from the freeze-in of the CMB. So cast of characters in the standard model. So you've all seen gauge theories in the quantum field theory course. So the standard model is it's an SU3 color times SU2 left times U1 hypercharge non-abelian gauge theory. So I'm going to use that frequently because I don't like writing it out. It's a non-abelian gauge theory, and it undergoes an electroweak phase transition. In which SU3 color is unaffected. SU2 left times U1 hypercharge. We call this factor hypercharge. It's a historical name. We're stuck with it. And the gauge group in the brackets breaks down to U1 electromagnetism when the Higgs boson gets a vacuum expectation value. So that's the basic structure of it. And there's a familiar way that we're used to hearing about it, talking about it. So familiar. So there's a familiar cast of characters where, you know, we're used to thinking of the Standard Model as something that happens to have quarks, gluons, a Higgs boson, force carriers, the W and the Z for the weak force, the gluons for the strong force. It's a theory of quarks, and they're, well, I guess I should say they're leptons, neutrinos, and so on. And we'll get to those in a little bit. But I just want to point out that this fundamental cast of characters is very energy specific. Energy specific. In other words, the gauge structure is always going to be what we say it is, at least over this range of validity. And in some sense, you're always going to be allowed to talk about the fundamental degrees of freedom in the way that we usually have them. But there are some caveats. And the caveats amount to the fact that in quantum field theory, couplings run. So you tell me what the electric charge of something is at a particular energy scale where characteristic momentum transfers are, say, the mass of the electron. And that's where alpha for the electromagnetic force would be, say, 1 over 137. But if you consider the electromagnetic force at higher energies, the value of that coupling constant might be something different. And in some other cases, say in the case of QCD with gluons and quarks, it could actually have a dramatically different value at a different energy scale, which means that our perturbative description of it might break down. That doesn't mean that the theory is wrong or that the gauge group somehow takes on a different form. It just means that we can't usually think of Feynman diagrams involving these particular degrees of freedom in the way that we would like. So that's just a caveat. It's not going to enter into our discussion very much. But in order to steer away from various phase transitions that the Standard Model can enter into, what we really mean is that we're considering mainly considering energies or temperatures, relevant if we're talking about the early universe. So mainly energies or temperatures that are about greater than or comparable to a parameter I'll call lambda QCD, which has the roughly the numerical value of 200 MeV. So this is 10 to the minus 3 GeV, well, the MeV is. And the rationale here is that below this, QCD is confined. It's confined, so quarks and gluons go into protons, neutrons, pions, and the zoo of the hadronic spectrum. And we're not going to talk very much about this, but the point is that the gauge group is still valid. But in order to talk sensibly about, say, QCD below this energy scale, we either need so we need some effective theory of protons, neutrons, pions, and so on. And these have been developed. We're not going to talk about this particular thing in this course. I just want to point it out. And this is where you change the degrees of freedom. So nu DOF, because the coupling constant for QCD is now non-perturbative. If you want to think about it in terms of quarks and gluons and Feynman diagrams, even the most straightforward calculation requires you to sum the whole perturbation series, and no one wants to do that. But of course, some people are crazy, and what they do is numerically do path integral. So if you numerically do the path integral, any description is fine. At any energy level, you're just getting the exact answer. And this falls under the umbrella of lattice QCD, where supercomputers are hooked up throughout the world, and they use basically as much CPU time as, you know, the United States military put together. And they do path integrals to tell you exactly how quarks and gluons interact very strongly to form composite objects like protons, pions, and so on. And they can get really good answers. So you can, from first principles, compute, say, the masses of these things to some degree of precision just doing the path integral and never worrying about the phase transition. So that's very impressive. We're not going to talk about it. The only point of this digression is to say that we're going to be concentrating on energies that are greater than lambda QCD, where this is not an issue. Yeah. And the other factor is that we're also we want energies that are greater than or comparable to about a TeV. Less than. That's important. So less than or comparable to a TeV, mainly because this is where, this is, well, when the universe is roughly at TeV temperatures, then the electroweak phase transition hasn't happened yet. And so then we can't really talk about the W and the Z as having mass. They, in some sense, have the wrong quantum numbers. They're not the right degrees of freedom, but not, they're not, certainly not the most convenient degrees of freedom with which to talk about the electroweak sector. So the electroweak phase transition happens. Below this, WZ are the bad degrees of freedom, and so on. So we're not going to talk about it. So we're going to focus on basically energies in this range. But the standard model, the structure is still valid even beyond these things. It's just that you'd have to think about them in a different way. And there's essentially no data beyond a TeV. This is roughly the lower distance bound that we know the standard model to be valid on. In principle, you could extend it to lower to shorter distances, but there's no experimental support, excuse me, beyond this, at least not till the LHC turns on. So this energy scale is also interesting because of the LHC. So it recently just found the Higgs in 2012. The LHC operates at about 14 TeV. That's the center of mass energy of proton-proton collisions. And unfortunately, because you have 14 TeV, we only know the standard model roughly to about a TeV, because when protons collide, they're composite objects. They have quarks and gluons in them. And by the time that the quarks and gluons scatter in any of these collisions, each constituent only ends up getting a small fraction of the momentum of the incoming particles. And so you're never actually converting all the energy into the things that you want to make. So we've never created a 14 TeV Higgs. Okay. Maybe I should, the front one can go all the way up. It'll take me a little while to get used to this. Okay. So now, cast of characters for real. Maybe I should move this up a little more. Okay. So let's just turn on the different gauge groups one by one. So let's turn on QCD. QCD stands for quantum chromodynamics. And at the risk of gross and inappropriate generalization, I'm just going to say it's like QED, only more so. So there, you're dealing with Feynman diagrams that are QED-like, but there's another gauge structure, so there are more photon-like particles, there are more electron-like particles, and so on. And so since we're dealing with an SU3 color gauge theory, the C doesn't mean anything special. It's just like any other SU3. This is just the name to remind us that it corresponds to QCD color. For any SUN group, SUN, you have n squared minus 1 generators, i.e. gauge bosons. And we call these gluons, so we'll call these G mu, they're spin 1. Spin 1 gluons, we have 8 of them. And before we introduce any quarks, their interactions are of the following form. So we'll write down the Feynman rules more carefully. This is just to give an idea of what kinds of things we'll expect in later lectures. So here, I don't want to use little g, I should use big G. So you'll have something like a trilinear diagram. There's no analog of this in QED. And this diagram scales as G strong. So this is the QCD coupling constant. And we just call this G strong. There's another diagram that characterizes gluon interactions. So this is the quartic diagram. So GGG, and this one scales as G strong squared. This one's dimensionless. Just a fun little fact to keep in the back of your minds for sanity checks and any calculations. Whenever there are two particles coming in and two particles coming out, the amplitude's always dimensionless in four dimensions. This amplitude it's not a 2-to-2 process. It's actually dimension full, so there's actually a derivative here. So this is something to sop up the dimensions. This is going to be momentum dependent. This is just a constant. And I'm writing squiggles because there's also going to be gauge structure. I don't want to write that now. We'll get to it in later lectures. This is just to foreshadow what's coming. So alpha strong, we're going to define an analogy with the fine structure constant of QED, so we're going to say it's G strong over 4 pi, G strong squared. And numerically, alpha strong measured at the mass of the Z boson is about 0.118. So compare that to, say, alpha QED, or alpha electromagnetism, evaluated at MZ, this is about 1 over 126. For MZ, about 90 GeV. It depends very strongly on what the energy of the process is. So this is very close to being non-perturbative at the Z-pole. So we measure this by colliding electrons and positrons at high center of mass energy, roughly around 90 GeV. You produce a Z boson on resonance, and then it decays to things that interact via the strong force, and some of the higher order corrections to these processes depend on alpha strong. And then you can extract alpha strong from the observed number of these things. So it's found to be roughly about 0.118. But once you get to around lambda QCD, where this description is no longer very convenient, then it actually blows up. So you need a better way of talking about quarks and gluons. So gluons also interact with quarks. So now we'll add these to the sector. So quarks are fundamentals of SU3, fundamental representation. So for each one, so each quark has three colors. Of course, they don't have colors, although in my mind, quarks are always blue. But each quark is going to have three colors. For each label of quark, there's going to be red, green, and blue. And this is a really cute naming system because if you think back to the old school television tubes, they would always have red, green, and blue for each pixel, and you can make just about any color with these. And so if I put together three kinds of objects in an SU3, I can make a color singlet. A singlet under SU3, i.e. it's uncharged, in the same way that, say, bringing a positive and negative charge together gives you something that's neutral under electromagnetism. You can make something that's neutral under QCD by bringing three things together, a red, a green, and a blue, which in TV language is white, which you can think of as being neutral. At least that's what they thought in the 60s, and so we're stuck with it. So they come in three colors, and there are three flavors. So there are three varieties. Let me just say that there are three generations. So we're going to have the up, the charm, and the top, the down, the strange, and the bottom. And I haven't really left myself very much space here, so I'm going to continue over here. So quarks. So each with three colors, they're the up types. So these are going to be the U, the charm, and the top quark. So these all have charge, electric charge, plus 2/3. The up quark is about 2 MeV in mass. The charm is, what is the charm? Okay, so the charm is about 1.2 GeV. So the mass of these things are known to usually about a few percent, because it's hard to measure things in QCD. You make stuff, but because the strong coupling constant is so large, there's lots and lots of radiation. The experimental signatures of these things are very messy. And so you'll never get super precise measurements of anything unless you're dealing with things that are very clean, like you're sitting on top of the resonance of the Z boson. But we'll get to these things later. And the top quark is about 175 GeV. No one knows why. 175 GeV, it has all the same quantum numbers as the up and the charm. It's way more massive than anything else. It's more massive than the Higgs. Open question, so figure it out. So why? Nobody knows. And then their down type. Down type quarks, so heuristically, well, literally, they have electric charge of minus one-third, but we'll deal with their quantum numbers in much more detail in a later lecture. So we've got the down quark, the strange quark, and the bottom quark. And the stupid naming system reflects the fact that nobody took any of this stuff seriously when it was first introduced. So there's the up, the down, the charm, the strange, the truth, and the beauty. Well, now we're stuck with it. So be careful how you name things. What did I do here? So the down is about 4.8 MeV. The strange is about 95 MeV. And the bottom is about 4.2 GeV. So the up and the down are stable. And they'd all be stable if it weren't for the electroweak force. So actually, at this level of the description, where we've only turned on QCD, they're all stable. There's nothing for them to decay into because QCD respects flavor. Well, these are stable no matter what. But in general, QCD so flavor meaning which of the generations we're talking about. So we usually think of this as the first generation, then this pair is the second generation, and this pair is the third generation. And we talk about flavor physics as changes of generations. So QCD, if we want to connect a quark, so we'll have a quark and an anti-quark, and I'll label their generations as I. The color indices are implicit. Yes?
In the standard model, does the SU3 color always come with the fundamental representation?
In the standard model, it's just an empirical fact that all the quarks are fundamental representations. The gluons are going to be adjoints because they're the gauge bosons. And it's an open question as to whether at shorter distances, so if the LHC could turn on in April, and it will turn on again in April, roughly, and it could discover something that's not any of these, it would be totally fine. You would easily be able to incorporate any other kind of representation, but none has been found in nature.
So when you describe the standard model and give the gauge groups to be complete or something, you would give all the representations for each of them?
No. So the standard model is literally just the cast of characters here. So in principle, it would be compatible with this gauge structure to add more stuff that carries a more exotic kind of representation. But so far in nature, we haven't discovered anything beyond the adjoint and the fundamental. Now in QCD, it's a little more complicated because you can get more exotic things once confinement sets in, because then you're adding quantum numbers in more intricate ways. But right now, it's only the ones that we're talking about. So gluons interact with quarks in a very QED-like way. I'm suppressing the color indices, but these diagrams will scale as G strong. And there's going to be a gamma mu, so left-handed and right-handed democracy. So gluons don't have any preference over left and right-handed quarks. And by left and right-handed, I just mean that if I have a Dirac fermion, that Dirac fermion contains a left-handed and a right-handed piece. The next lecture will go into this in quite a bit more detail, because the standard model in the other sectors cares a lot about whether you're a left-handed or a right-handed fermion. And I'll just define psi left in the Dirac language as 1 half 1 minus gamma 5 times psi Dirac, where gamma 5 is just I times the product of all the other gamma matrices, 1 through 4, or 0 through 3, I guess. And while the right would just be, I should be careful about how I write this. So there we go. And so there are no flavor changing transitions in the QCD sector, and gluons, just like photons, they don't care specifically about whether you're left-handed or a right-handed fermion. It couples to both in the same way. And that's all I want to say about QCD for now. Well, except for the fact that below lambda QCD, so when energies or ambient temperatures are below about 200 MeV, you form bound states. So this is confinement. And the kinds of bound states that we see most commonly are mesons. So that's where you've got a quark and an anti-quark, not necessarily of the same flavor. They'll be bound together by QCD, but the gluons that bind them together don't know anything about the indices of the flavor. So this is a meson. Contains two quarks, a quark and an anti-quark. It's neutral under color, so there's always going to be, say, red and anti-red. And you've also got baryons. So Q, Q, Q. And these will always be of the form red, green, and blue. And they can be different flavors bound together in their own little family unit, I guess. And that's all I want to say about QCD for now. So, okay, so now let's turn on SU2 left cross U1 hypercharge. So we call this one hypercharge. Not to be confused with electromagnetism. They're totally different. Well, they're related. They're linear combinations of these things. So this is, well, this whole thing is, so the electroweak force, so above, above TeV energies, these are just distinct. Below a TeV, the Higgs vacuum expectation value, which I'll also call a VEV. The Higgs VEV is not zero, and that means that SU2 left cross U1y goes to U1 electromagnetism, and then we get W, Z, and gamma. These are all the spin 1 force carriers. If we're above this, the better degrees of freedom might be, say, x1, x2, x3, and y. And then once the Higgs gets its VEV, you get a W boson, a Z boson, and a gamma. And the gamma and Z are linear combinations of these two. the 1 and the 2 will pair up in a different linear combination to give the W plus and minus. And we'll see that in gory detail later. But for now, let's just remind ourselves that MW is 80 point, I want to get this right, because this is known really well. So it's 80.385 plus or minus 0.0015 GeV. Z0 is 91.187 plus or minus 0.0021 GeV. These are known really well, and there are Nobel Prizes associated with their discovery, so I'm just going to say Nobel. Nobels. So the discovery and the theory, multiple Nobel Prizes. And it's a short-range force. For these two. They correspond to short-range forces. After the electroweak phase transition, we can call this just the weak force involving just the W and the Z, and the potential for the weak force goes like E to the MW or Z times R over R. So there's some exponential suppression in the range of the force. This is why it wasn't discovered right away. This is why we knew about electromagnetism back in the days of, ancient Greek days, but we knew a lot about the actual electromagnetic theory in the 1700s, 1800s. This was only discovered in the 20th century or the very late 19th century because it's very short range. And the range basically goes like 1 over MW or 1 over MZ. And so this roughly maps onto the 10 to the minus 15 centimeter distances. So right at the lower edge of what we know about the Standard Model empirically. And the gauge bosons interact with quarks. With W and Z. So once we turn on quarks, I can have an up-type quark and a down-type quark. So this tells us it could be, you know, U1 would be, say, the up, U3 would be the top, and so on. It could be either combination of any generation, but one has to be an up-type and the other one has to be a down-type. And this will talk to the W. Yes?
The upper limit being 1 TeV. Do we know that for sure, or is that just like our limit of experiment because we can't get any higher?
It's just the latter. So in principle, the Standard Model is defined all the way up to the Planck scale. The only thing we know for sure, at least in terms of this architecture, is that it would break down if you try to incorporate quantum gravity, because that's not part of the theory. It wouldn't be renormalizable. But in principle, if you're willing to swallow the fact that your initial conditions are uncertain, so you tune to get the CMB right, you tune to get the matter-antimatter asymmetry and so on, and you just add dark matter in by hand, the actual architecture of the Standard Model is valid up to the Planck scale. And in fact, that's one of the reasons that now that we've discovered the Higgs, you can ask questions that push the Standard Model all the way up to the Planck scale. And so you can ask, well, okay, how stable is the potential of the Higgs boson? And it turns out that it's actually not stable, or that it's very likely to be metastable on cosmological timescales if the Standard Model is taken at face value all the way up to the Planck scale. So that would mean that our vacuum would decay and we'd all die soon. Not that soon. But this is a naive extrapolation because there is all that other crap that we have to add to it, which would likely change the story.
Okay.
That also depends to some extent. We don't know it for sure. We know that it has to roughly be in that range unless something super dramatic takes place, because we've got a pretty good idea of what the thermal history of the universe is up to not quite that temperature, but not that far off either. And so you could imagine changing that by adding things that are slightly heavier, and so some of their virtual effects would change how the story goes, but it wouldn't necessarily be detectable by what we've seen so far. You had a question? Or no? Oh, okay. All right, so quarks interacting with the W, always, so this W has has charge plus or minus one, so particle and antiparticle have opposite charges, and it always interacts with one up type, so always with up and down. And it can, can change flavor. So the W is actually what's responsible for radioactive decay by and large, because you can take, say, a top quark, and then the top quark can live here. You can put the down quark on the other end of the Feynman diagram, and that would give you a decay. So there would just be one initial state particle and two final state particles. You need changes of flavor in order for some of these more exotic things to decay. For the Z, well, I should give myself a little more room. So for the Z, I can have up I and down I, or, so this is an or, and up bar I, down bar I, interacting with the Z. So here, the Z is neutral. So this is like the bulkier cousin of the photon. It couples in much the same way that the photon does. But I should add that both of these care a lot about whether you're left-handed or right-handed. So the Z doesn't change flavor at tree level. And that story will change at loop level. The W changes it at tree. The Z will only do it at higher order effects. Both care about left-handed versus right-handed fermions. And in other words, we say that the standard model is chiral. So it cares about which part of the Dirac spinner you're coupling to. Different parts of the Dirac spinner for each kind of fermion will have different charges under the W and the Z. Yeah.
If the W goes on the decay you've got there, the interaction, you have like just up interacting with anti-down. Can you also get like anti-up interacting with down?
Yes, that's right. Sorry. Yeah, so you can switch that around. That depends on whether this is a plus or a minus. So this is always plus one, so you can always just make sure you conserve charge and everything allowed is possible. So do I still have time till the end of the hour? Oh, cool. Okay. So I guess I should... Okay. Okay, so now let's add leptons. So leptons, they're just like any other fermions, only they feel no strong force. So they don't feel QCD, but their generation structure is very similar. So you'll have the electron plus or minus, the muon plus or minus, and the tau plus or minus. So this is the first generation, the second generation, and the third generation. And the electron is 0.511 MeV. The muon is about 106 MeV. And the tau is about 1776 MeV. Is a very important number for the USA. And we have neutrinos. So the distinction between electrons and neutrinos is basically like the distinction between up-type and down-type quarks. And that's no accident. They're organized in a similar sort of way before the electroweak phase transition. So actually, if you turned off QCD entirely, then the analogy would be exact. You turned off QCD and only had electroweak interactions, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between, say, electrons and electron neutrinos, which would basically be like up-type and down-type fermions. But we do have QCD, so it matters a lot. And so for every kind of charged lepton, these are all charged plus minus one for these. The electrons in the standard model, or sorry, the neutrinos in the standard model are all massless, and this is wrong. So one piece of evidence against the standard model is that neutrinos have mass, and the mass allows them to oscillate between different kinds of flavors. This is a very minor correction to the standard model. It doesn't undermine the overall architecture. It just means that you have to add right-handed neutrinos too. So once we do that, and we'll see how that works, the whole story basically stays the same, up to other things that you can do, other experiments you can perform, and so on. But you're going to have a neutrino for each kind of lepton species. They're all going to be massless in the standard model, and we're not really going to talk very much about what their masses are. Although they have, well, their mass differences have been measured so far. Leptons and the W. Since the neutrinos are massless in the standard model, I'm not going to care so much about flavor changes in their interactions with the W. Technically, there would be an analog of the flavor changing process once you've added neutrino masses in the interactions with the W boson, but we're not going to worry about that. So for the time being, let's just agree that we're going to have a charged lepton and the corresponding neutrino, and we'll ignore the fact that there is some possibility of flavor changing in the real world, but not in the standard model. And this thing goes like G weak times gamma mu times P left, roughly. So P left is 1 half 1 minus gamma 5. There's a similar kind of structure for quarks, but I'm not going to get into that right now. We'll deal with that in later lectures. And that's the only kind of interaction between the W and the leptons. If we have the leptons and the Z, or the Z, then Li bar times the Z. So sometimes I'll use plus and minus to denote particle versus antiparticle, sometimes particle and a bar. I hope the context is usually clear, but please ask if it's not. And the Z, because it's basically like a photon, will typically just couple particle and antiparticle of the same kind. The W won't, but here it mostly only cares about the left-handed part. So these are all gamma mu P left, and I put quotation marks around it because the Z does couple somewhat to the right-handed parts too, but in a different way than it does to the left-handed parts. So we'll get into the details. This is just to remind us all that these interactions care a lot about what kind of fermion you are. So we have just a couple more minutes. Let me just say one thing. So the last part of this introduction, which I'll save for tomorrow morning, I guess, is just the Higgs sector. So that's the only cast member that we haven't seen so far. So I'll pause that for now. So yes? Oh, this is the projector. Sorry, good. So PL, it's just the left-handed projector. So Psi Dirac is PL Psi Dirac plus P right Psi Dirac, where if I define P sub L or P sub right to be 1 half 1 minus gamma 5, so this is in four-component language. Pardon? Minus plus, yes, thank you. And we think about the gamma matrices as gamma 5 is I times gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3. Then this thing will end up projecting out, well, so P left will project out, it'll look something like this. So there'll be a 2 by 2 identity matrix, and so that when I act with P sub left on psi left, psi right, it just gives me back psi left and zero. Okay, so that's the whole point of having, and there's a similar thing for the right-handed one. It's just that for the right-handed one, the identity matrix would be down here, I think. And so I guess that's all I wanted to cover today, but yes?
With like all the non-neutrino species, as you increase in generation, you increase in mass. Although we don't know neutrino masses yet, do we know that they'll increase in mass as well, or is that just a...
So that's actually an open question. There are different theories, and they depend a lot on what upcoming experiments learn. So what we know so far is that the neutrino mass hierarchy Well, we know some of the mass differences, but we don't. But what we do know is sort of degenerate between a number of different scenarios. So I would say the jury's still out on that. Yeah.
But we don't know that, say, like the electron neutrino is the lightest of the three.
Well, it would be an admixture because they mix. There's an incompatibility of mass eigenbases and interaction eigenbases, something that's going to be very analogous to what we'll see in the quark sector when we talk about flavor. And that's ultimately what's responsible for the fact that when you couple the quarks to the W, you have this possibility of changing flavors, because when you try to write down everything, when you try to diagonalize all the mass terms in your Lagrangian, you have to perform unitary transformations on the quarks in generation space. When you do that, for the leptons at least, in the case where the neutrinos are massless, you can do so in a way that eliminates all the matrices from the theory. For the quarks, you can't do that because the structure of the standard model cares a whole lot about whether you're left-handed or right-handed, and Dirac mass terms are left-hand times right-handed fermions, then the rotations that you perform show up in other places, and they can't be removed entirely, and one convenient place to put them is in the coupling to the W. For the Z, they can all be eliminated because you're always acting with the same kind and the anti of the same kind. For the W, there's going to be one matrix that'll diagonalize, say, all the up quark mass terms, and one matrix that'll diagonalize all the down quark mass terms, but then the kinetic term combines them. The kinetic term that couples in the covariant derivative that couples these quarks to the W, it'll reappear there, and that'll give you the possibility of flavor transitions. Okay, I think we're over time, so I'll see you tomorrow.